Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is astrophysicist Dr. Kelly Holly Bachelman. Kelly, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
This is going to be cool. You are an associate professor of astrophysics at Vanderbilt University, Nashville, with a specialty of supermassive black holes and gravitational waves. That is so cool.
Yep, it is. I think I'm pretty lucky to get paid cash money to do this, though.
Yeah, yay! That is nice. Yay. So I want to talk about your specialties in a minute. But as we do on Background Mode, we like to find out from successful people how they kind of, you know, landed where they are today and the story about their career. I know you talked about the time when you grew up in Montana that you would just lay on the ground and look up at the night sky. How did those dark skies affect your path? Was it seeing the Milky Way and wondering? Was it the planets? Was it looking through a telescope? How did that all get started?
I probably was in love with astronomy, well, before I can even remember the name of the word astronomer. So by the time I was in Montana, I was already a teenager. And you know, that was just kind of taking in something that I already loved. But back then, when I would lay out in a field, I could see the Milky Way. And that was so transformative to me to think about how many stars were there. And then you're right. I was thinking about the stars and all the planets around those stars and wondering if there were civilizations up there that were also looking up at their sky and imagining what they would see and just kind of lamenting that I would never in my lifetime be able to visit any of those places. But I kind of made it my mission to try and learn as much as I could about the universe in which we live. So, by the time I was laying out in the night sky, looking at the night sky, I was already, it was already a big love for me. But it was very transformative to me to kind of keep my resolve to keep looking at the sky.
I know when I see the Milky Way at night, I have this feeling that I'm looking at the disk of the galaxy that's, 30,000 light years away, and it's big, and yes, it's glorious, and it just creates almost a spiritual sense within you.
It is. It's the closest thing I've found to God, really.
Did you then buy a telescope and become like an amateur astronomer, like, you know? We all bought a 3-inch refractor or something in Tasco.
I would have loved to, but we just couldn't afford it. So no, I never had a telescope, and I was never an amateur astronomer. But every so often, I would look at the astronomy magazines when we could save up enough money to go buy one, and then see like all the fancy technological telescopes that were out there, and I imagined that would be very cool to have one, but yeah,
we can
never
name
had
names.
One.
That's okay. I'll bet it was Sky and Telescope.
It was, yes, yeah.
So then you get into your undergraduate days, and I take it you're all in with astrophysics. Was that your degree then? You just knew.
Oh yeah, I knew. Like I said, I knew before I even knew what the name was that I wanted to be an astrophysicist. But yeah, by the time I was an undergrad, they didn't have an astrophysics degree. So I got a physics degree, but I knew already what I was going to do with it. And I remember being an undergrad and taking my first proper physics class. And it was the first, entry ticket into becoming an astronomer. And, my very first chance to show my stuff. And I hated it. So it was about vectors and incline planes.
I was just going to say, that can bore you to tears when you're a young astronomer.
And I thought that somehow was a clue that maybe I shouldn't be an astronomer. So I had this big existential crisis. But I kept going. And thankfully, the physics got more elegant. And then I fell in love with it again.
By the time you get to Maxwell's equations, you're pretty well hooked.
Yes, Lagrangians made me happy again.
Yeah, yeah. So my wife's a professor, and a lot of her students seem to be thinking in terms of instant success. You know, they take one class in Python, they think they're going to go to work for Pixar. Mm-hmm. So, and I went through that process myself, as you know, of graduate school in astrophysics. So just for the sake of those who are listening in, tell us, from the time you were a freshman in college until you landed a faculty job, do the math real quick, how many years was that?
So I'm just going to walk people through the path.
Okay.
It was 4 years. It was 4 years as an undergrad and mm-hmm. then 6 years in grad school. So there's 10 years just to get your PhD. And then I did a series of postdocs, three postdocs, each of which are 2 to 3 years. So altogether, it was about six. In this case, it was 18 years until I landed a faculty position.
My wife tells her students that. She says, yeah. It's going to take years. And they don't listen. But this is why we do the show, is so people are both inspired and sobered a little bit about how, if you want to be really successful, it takes a lot of patience and takes a lot of time.
A lot of my students, when they're in my office and they, you know, maybe they're not understanding something, you know, they'll get discouraged almost when sometimes I know the answer and sometimes I don't, but I'll just remind them, you know, I've had decades of experience at this. So, you know, when I was at your stage, it didn't come easy. And each step of the way, you're learning something. So you're absolutely right. It takes a long, long time, but it's a long time of learning really cool stuff about the universe. So, you know, it's not wasted time for sure.
So you got your PhD from the University of Michigan, as I mm-hmm. understand it.
Yep.
Is that when you started to get interested in black holes, or was it when you were in your postdoc phase?
I was interested in black holes as an undergrad. So, in fact, the way this was before the internet, ladies and gentlemen, but when I was applying to graduate school, I wanted to study black holes. So I went to the library and got a bunch of astrophysical journal papers and read about black holes, and then looked at the author lists and figured out who did work in black holes and where they were. And so I stalked my PhD advisor down to the University of Michigan and applied to grad school there.
Helps to do your homework.
Yeah.
So when you work on black hole physics, is this done analytically anymore, or is it 100% computer simulations these days?
Almost all of it is computer simulations. So in my particular field, we're trying to understand black hole interacts with the host galaxy and the host dark matter halo, the big pool of dark matter that basically surrounds and defines a galaxy. So so we're not even very close to the black hole, and all of that interactions, those many, many, many gravitational interactions, just require computers to calculate. So even though each individual calculation is really simple, there's so many of them that we have to do it with a computer.
There's a black hole at the center of the Milky Way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How many million solar masses do we know?
It's roughly 4 million solar masses.
Which is not a big black hole. It sounds like a lot.
It does.
But I think there are many that are much heavier.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So currently, things that are around 10 billion solar masses are kind of at the top, you know, the heavyweights in the black hole world.
Super massive.
That's right. Super, super massive. Ultra massive is what some people call them. But ours is just 4 million solar masses, and it's just a teeny, teeny, teeny fraction of the mass of our galaxy. So our galaxy itself is about a million times more massive than that.
Well, you brought up a good point a little while ago. You talked about black holes at the center of the galaxy and dark matter. Mm-hmm. For a long time, as a sort of an amateur observer, I've understood that a black hole is essential for our galaxy to form and be cohesive. Is that still the thinking, or is dark matter now part of the equation, pardon the pun?
I would say that if you asked a theorist what made a galaxy, depending upon exactly who you talk to, the theorist might actually say the galaxy's the dark matter. You know, dark matter pervades everything. We are sitting in a sea of dark matter right now. It's not the dominant thing right near where we are, but it's definitely the dominant thing in our galaxy. So, in fact, all the stars of our galaxy are kind of just along the ride.
Tag-alongs,
they're,
huh?
Yeah, they are. They're like kind of like icing on the cake of a dark matter halo. And you know, even kind of less important in terms of mass is the supermassive black hole at the very center. So I don't think people think necessarily nowadays that the black hole is the essential seed to form the galaxy, but you're definitely right that black holes and galaxies tend to form together, and black holes seem to be an essential ingredient in a galaxy.
Interesting.
But, yeah. And go ahead. Sorry.
That's all right. How do you do these computations? Do you use a local supercomputer, or do you get on some sort of optic fiber to a supercomputer at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, or how do you do these computations at Vanderbilt?
Yeah, so we do a bunch of tests on local supercomputers here at Vanderbilt. We have a supercomputer that has about 6,000 computers together and supercluster. But those are only for tests and kind of getting up to speed. And then when we have our production runs, we run on national supercomputers. Like, you're exactly right. We run one at Oak Ridge National Lab, and we run some at
Roadrunner, right?
In Texas.
Is that still in operation? Or maybe
Stampede
Roadrunner was
now.
The old one.
That's right. Now it's called Stampede.
Ah, okay.
Which you can kind of imagine. I kind of imagine all these computers kind of running like a stampede, like a bunch of horses taking off.
Do you have really great visualization tools? Because I'm just checking in with you, because the last time I checked on this, there's lots of computation done through, you know, terminal commands and organizing and compiling Fortran programs. I'm probably out of date. But the visualization part tended to be kind of separate from that, because the supercomputers aren't set up for that. Do you do all the number crunching and then bring it back and visualize on your Macs? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, we'll mostly do all the number crunching and get a whole bunch of just gigantic files, terabytes and terabytes of just data. And that data is, you know, here's where this dark matter particle is, and that's how fast it's moving, and that's what its analytic potential is, et cetera, et cetera. And then we do visualization, sometimes also on a supercomputer, just that specializes in visualization, but it's kind of done after the fact. So yeah, you're right. Most of the number crunching is on one type of machine, and then the visualization is on a different type of machine.
Is that done on Macs with big displays, or is just, because I'm going to ask you in a few minutes about your predilection for Macs, or do you use like Hewlett Packard Z workstations with giant displays or something like that?
So my displays aren't that great, but I do use a Mac, and mostly my Mac is for making keynote presentations and to SSH and to log on to a supercomputer to do real work.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm talking to you on a Mac Pro, by the way, the beautiful black cylinder. Apple's had some troubles with that machine in terms of satisfying the customers, but it is a glorious little machine. I know an astrophysicist, Dr. Gaurav Khanna, mm-hmm. at the University of Massachusetts, who uses a Mac Pro for his calculations. He's into black holes as well.
Nice.
So I want to ask you some technical questions about your specialties of gravitational waves and black holes, but this seems like a really good time to take a break. Okay, so we'll be back in 60 seconds. Folks, stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm talking to Dr. Kelly Holly Buckelman, astrophysicist. So now I'm going to set you up with some softball pitches here now, because I want to get into some fun stuff for those listeners who may not know some of the details. So your understanding of black holes and gravitational waves requires an understanding of what's called space-time. One word. Tell me about space-time.
Sure. Essentially, it's kind of like what it sounds like. In order to think about our universe, we think about sort of a fabric that is four-dimensional, three dimensions of space and one of time, and all events in our universe. And in fact, the way that in which we define our universe so far is through the existence of space-time and the things that happen in it. So space-time to me is this just four-dimensional construct that's hard to visualize, which is why people always think about this fabric. And gravity, for example, happens because you get a bend in space-time. So time changes and also space changes in the presence of matter.
What's interesting is that objects tend to travel in a straight line in space-time on a geodesic. Mm-hmm. But to us mortals in three dimensions, we see it as a curve, and that's the orbit. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. So does a black hole have to do something to generate these gravitational waves, or can it just sit there?
That's a really great question. So I'm going to take a step back and mm-hmm. just say that, you know, when matter exists, it bends space-time, like you had said. And what makes a black hole is just matter that's really compact. And it's so compact that the bend in space-time is really sharp and, in fact, sort of formally infinite. And that makes that's what defines a black hole. Now, what makes gravitational waves is when matter moves. So, for example, if a black hole were just sitting there, perfectly still and perfectly spherically symmetric, it's not moving matter, and so it would not radiate gravitational waves. But, for example, if you wave your hand back and forth, kind of like I'm doing now, that's me moving matter, and that would make a gravitational wave.
So it's sort of like an aircraft carrier sitting at sea. If it's just sitting there,
not
the sea is quiet, nothing happens. But if they fire up the engines and they start making some sharp turns, and this 80,000 tons starts moving and vibrating and shaking, then waves are going to emanate out from the ship. Is that a good analogy?
That is a good analogy. There's just one tiny, just for, you know, for pro tips, is that if that aircraft carrier were just bobbing up and down kind of normally and perfectly spherically symmetrically in space time, that doesn't make gravitational waves. So, for example, if a black hole were right now, I'm making hand motions that almost make it look like it's breathing. So getting smaller and getting bigger and getting smaller and getting bigger. That in itself is a perfectly spherically symmetric motion. So that, weirdly enough, does not make a wave in space time.
What about two black holes orbiting each other?
That's a perfect one, because that makes kind of an asymmetric wobble in space-time, and so that makes a wave. So stuff that's not perfectly spherically symmetric and moving, if it's matter, that makes gravitational wave.
Cool. And how fast do these gravitational waves travel?
They travel at the speed of light, just like an electromagnetic wave.
Are there photons associated with these waves?
Nope, this is a wave in space-time. So, you know, the analogy to electromagnetic radiation to light is really, really close in that, you know, hey, both of them are waves, both of them contain energy, both mm-hmm. of them travel at the speed of light. But I think to me, the biggest difference, well, there's lots of differences, but the one thing I like to keep in mind is that a gravitational wave is space-time. Light moves through space-time. So it's a photon that's moving through space-time, you know, traveling along the bumps and wiggles of space-time. But a gravitational wave is the bumps and wiggles of space-time itself.
A ripple.
Yep.
So if a gravitational wave from a black hole event, like you described, millions of light years away, were to sweep over the Earth, would we humans feel it?
Nope. In fact, right now, we're being bathed in the sum total of all of the basically all of the motion of all of the matter that's not perfectly spherically symmetric in the universe. So all the matter everywhere is making gravitational waves, and they're sweeping through us right now, and we can't feel a thing. And the reason why is just because gravitational waves are so weak compared to all the other forces that are holding us to the chair and holding us together.
So that brings me up to my next question, nicely timed here. So on September 14th, 2015, scientists at the, now here's a mouthful, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, called LIGO, made the discovery of the first gravitational wave. Can you describe what LIGO is, how it works, and how it can detect those minuscule gravitational waves that we can't feel?
Sure. So LIGO tries to measure the length of space-time in two different directions. So right now I'm holding my arms, one arm straight in front and one arm straight to the side.
Ah, the TED Talk.
So I'm thinking, I am thinking about two different directions in space-time. And this laser interferometer uses light to basically travel along one arm of this interferometer in one direction, and then also light moving in another direction, kind of perpendicular to it. And that is, if they set the light, like a light race almost, if they start the clock and set light beams in two different directions, we use the fact that light has a constant speed to basically time how long it takes those photons to get back to back together again. If the distance in space-time is constant, is the same in both of those two directions, then both photons in each direction will come back right at the same time. So nobody wins the race.
How do you tag a photon? Is it sort of the interference principle where you look at fringing?
Exactly. That's what happens. Yes. So if they come back at exactly the same time, they interfere, the two waves interfere with one another, and basically you don't detect anything. But if the actual space-time itself is longer in one direction than another, it takes light a longer time to go one direction versus the other, one wave wins the race. And so the two photons kind of don't interfere with one another very well. You make fringe patterns that that your detector can detect.
That has to be some very sophisticated electronics to measure a distance. I read that's 1/10,000th of a proton diameter. That must be some awesome electronics to be able to catch that fringe change.
It's absolutely, it is the most exquisite, most delicate experiment ever conducted by humankind. We are working, we meaning human beings who are involved all over the world on the LIGO project, are detecting things, you're exactly right, a fraction of the length of a proton, a subatomic particle. They're looking for differences in space-time that are that small. And, you know, lots of things can mimic that. So you can have lots of noise, just straight up air in the tubes that hold the laser can give you a fake interference pattern. People walking nearby can cause wobbles in the detector that look like a gravitational wave. Airplanes causing a sonic boom can also have the air kind of bounce up against the tunnel and give you a fake fake signal. So yeah, people
do you have
had
all kinds
work
of sensors and news feeds and connections to the outside world, so you can say, oh yeah, there was a car crash at 12:04 a.m.
Yes, actually there was an actual car crash into one of the detectors once. So yeah, they definitely had to detect that. Apparently, someone was telling me that there were sometimes shooting practice nearby, and so like one of the detectors got shot at. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of like human interference and natural interference from our Earth, and just quantum interference, photon noise in the laser, all of which can combine to give you some statistical noise that you have to overcome. So it's just an exquisite experiment. I'm so happy and proud of human beings that we worked so long for decades to be able to detect this tiny, tiny signal.
Tell me about what caused the signal. Was this two supermassive black holes doing something they hadn't been doing before that generated the signal, and how far away was it?
So that's actually the coolest part to me. This little tiny 1/10,000th of a proton inch change in space-time happened at Earth, first in one LIGO detector and then at a companion detector on the other side of the U.S. But that was from two black holes, one that was about 40 times the mass of the sun, and one was about 30 times the mass of our sun. They were spiraling around each other and then collided, making a big, catastrophic ripple in space-time that propagated out for a billion years to finally just wobble us just a little bit.
So the orbit kind of decayed and they crashed into each other, and then doink, out came the disturbance and in space-time.
Absolutely. Yeah, in fact, I mean, if you think about it, gravitational waves are radiation. So the fact that these two black holes are close together, radiating away gravitational energy, takes energy away from their orbit and causes the orbit to decay and smash together and make more gravitational waves.
Cool. So yeah, now I want to ask you about the big picture here now, a chance to do some sales work. How does our understanding, we may not know we don't know everything about the implications of our understanding, but Neil deGrasse Tyson likes to talk about the cosmic perspective and how we understand we're fitting into the universe. Do you have any sense about how this discovery, momentous as it is, helps us sort of figure out a better cosmic perspective, if I phrase that right?
I see what you mean. I think this is so profound because it gives us an entirely new window onto the universe. Every single thing that we know about our universe, our distant universe at least, comes from light. Maybe some neutrinos and some subatomic particles, but basically stuff in the electromagnetic spectrum. That's it. And there's most of our matter in the universe doesn't emit at least very much, or if at all, electromagnetically. And so there's a whole spectrum, a whole sector of our universe that's dark and that we have no way currently, well, until now, to be able to understand. But now, all of a sudden, we have gravitational waves that we can detect that can tell us about matter in our universe, that can tell us about this dark sector of dark energy and dark matter, that we can't know everything about it right now, but we at least now know that there's another window that we can use to detect things
tool,
in our universe.
A new instrument,
that's right.
A new way of looking at the universe, a new way of discovering things. Who knows where
entirely
that could lead?
Different. Yes,
who
yes.
Knows? Yeah.
I think that's the best part, is that that I can't tell you right now what we're going to learn, because this is so fundamentally different type of information.
Right. Well, we only have a few minutes left in the show. This has been great. I want to take the final few minutes to ask you, because many of our listeners are lovers of Apple products and Macintosh users. How did you first come to be enamored with Macintoshes? Was it the Unix
yes.
part of it? Was that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love the underlying OS. It looks the most like a supercomputer system. I can pull up Xquartz term and I can type in things that a supercomputer will understand and that my Mac can understand. And so I feel much more seamlessly like I'm doing research when I'm on my Mac.
What kind of Mac do you have? Or which ones do you have?
Do I have? I have a couple, but the thing I have right now, apparently, I'm pulling up my Mac. Come on. It is a MacBook Pro, 13-inch, late 2013. Well, it's not that awesome, but I mean, it is awesome, but I'm just saying I need to upgrade it. I was just looking. Oh, man, time for a new one.
Well, Macs last for a long time. They're built really well. That's nothing. That's a pretty good computer you got there. Do you use any desktop Macs in the office as well?
I don't, but I do have several Mac laptops.
Okay, are Macs favored at Vanderbilt by the faculty, at least in the astronomy department? Or
Oh, yeah. I will only, I mean, sorry, but I'll only buy Macs for my students. And I do know lots of us, if we're not doing supercomputing, we're doing Mac computing.
Yay.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, I just love, like I said, I love the OS. It's really fantastic.
Cool. Well, to wrap up here, for just a few minutes we have left, I read that you work with a program to encourage women and minorities to pursue careers in science. Tell me about that.
Sure. So I'm the co-director of the Fisk Vanderbilt Master's to PhD Bridge Program. This is a program that by now is about 12 years old. And what it's designed to do is help folks who are maybe first generation, underrepresented minorities, women, people who are not traditionally thought of as academic PhD astronomers, to first earn a master's degree at Fisk and get mentoring and tutoring if they need it, professional development, and just a lot of support to be able to become PhD scientists.
Cool. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to thank you for being on the show. This has been great. Grand Tour of the Universe.
Thank you so much.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Sure. My email address is kelly.gravity@gmail.com.
Excellent. So, folks, I'm glad you came by, and always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.